I never got to like Carrie White, and I never trusted Sue Snell's motives in sending her boyfriend to the prom with her. But I did have something there, like a whole career. Tabby somehow knew it, and by the time I had piled up 50 single-space pages, I knew it, too. For one thing, I didn't think any of the characters who went to Carrie White's prom would ever forget it. Those few who lived through it, that was. I had written 3 other novels before Carrie. Rage, The Long Walk, and The Running Man were later published. Rage is the most troubling of them. The Long Walk may be the best of them. But none of them taught me the things I learned from Carrie White. The most important is that the writer's original perception of a character, or characters, may be as erroneous as the reader's. Running a close second was the realization that stopping a piece of work just because it's hard, either emotionally or imaginatively, is a bad idea. Sometimes you have to go on when you don't feel like it, and sometimes you're doing good work when it feels like all you're managing is to shovel shit from a sitting position. Tabby helped me, beginning with the information that the sanitary napkin dispensers in high schools were usually not coin-op. Faculty and administration didn't like the idea of girls walking around with blood all over their skirts just because they happened to come to school short a quarter, my wife said. And I also helped myself, digging back to my memories of high school. My job teaching English didn't help. I was 26 by then, and on the wrong side of the desk. Remembering what I knew about the 2 loneliest, most reviled girls in my class. How they looked, how they acted, how they were treated. Very rarely in my career have I explored more distasteful territory. I'll call one of these girls Sandra. She and her mother lived in a trailer home not too far from me with their dog, Cheddar Cheese. Sandra had a burbly, uneven voice, as if she were always speaking through a throat full of tightly packed phlegm. She wasn't fat, but her flesh had a loose, pale look, like the undersides of some mushrooms. Her hair clung to her pimply cheeks in tight little orphan Annie curls. She had no friends, except for Cheddar Cheese, I guess. One day, her mother hired me to move some furniture. Dominating the trailer's living room was a nearly life-sized crucified Jesus, eyes turned up, mouth turned down, blood dribbling from beneath the crown of thorns on his head. He was naked except for a rag twisted around his hips and loins. Above this bit of breech clout were the hollowed belly and the jutting ribs of a concentration camp inmate. It occurred to me that Sandra had grown up beneath the agonal gaze of this dying god, and doing so had undoubtedly played a part in making her what she was when I knew her, a timid and homely outcast who went scuttling through the halls of Lisbon High like a frightened mouse. "That's Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior," Sandra's mother said, following my gaze. "Have you been saved, Steve?" I hastened to tell her I was saved as saved could be, although I didn't think you could ever be good enough to have that version of Jesus intervene on your behalf. The pain had driven him out of his mind. You could see it on his face. If that guy came back, he probably wouldn't be in a saving mood. The other girl, I'll call Dodie Franklin. Only the other girls called her Dodo, or Doo-Doo. Her parents were interested in only one thing, and that was entering contests. They were good at them, too. They had won all sorts of odd stuff, including a year's supply of 3 Diamonds brand fancy tuna and Jack Benny's Maxwell automobile. The Maxwell sat off to the left of their house in that part of Durham known as Southwest Bend, gradually sinking into the landscape. Every year or two, one of the local papers, the Portland Press-Herald, the Lewiston Sun, the Lisbon Weekly Enterprise, would do a piece on all the weird shit Dodie's folks had won in raffles and sweepstakes and giant prize drawings. Usually there would be a photo of the Maxwell, or Jack Benny with his violin, or both. Whatever the Franklins might have won, a supply of clothes for growing teenagers wasn't part of the haul. Dodie and her brother Bill wore the same stuff every day for the first year and a half of high school. Black pants and short-sleeved checked sports shirt for him, a long black skirt, gray knee socks, and a sleeveless white blouse for her. Some of my readers may not believe I am being literal when I say every day, but those who grew up in country towns during the 50s and 60s will know that I am. In the Durham of my childhood, life wore little or any makeup. I went to school with kids who wore the same neck dirt for months, kids whose skin festered with sores and rashes, kids with the eerie, dried apple doll faces that result from untreated burns, kids who were sent to school with stones in their dinner buckets and nothing but air in their thermoses. It wasn't Arcadia. For the most part, it was Dogpatch with no sense of humor. Dodie and Bill Franklin got on all right at Durham Elementary, but high school meant a much bigger town, and for children like Dodie and Bill, Lisbon Falls meant ridicule and ruin. We watched in amusement and horror as Bill's sports shirt faded and began to unravel from the short sleeves up. He replaced a missing button with a paperclip. Tape, carefully colored black with a crayon to match his pants, appeared over a rip behind one knee. Dodie's sleeveless white blouse began to grow yellow with wear, age, and accumulated sweat stains. As it grew thinner, the straps of her bra showed through more and more clearly. The other girls made fun of her, at first behind her back and then to her face. Teasing became taunting. The boys weren't a part of it. We had Bill to take care of. Yes, I helped. Not a whole lot, but I was there. Dodie had it worse, I think. The girls didn't just laugh at Dodie. They hated her, too. Dodie was everything they were afraid of. After Christmas vacation of our sophomore year, Dodie came back to school resplendent. The dowdy old black skirt had been replaced by a cranberry-colored one that stopped at her knees instead of halfway down her shins. The tatty knee socks had been replaced by nylon stockings, which looked pretty good because she had finally shaved the luxuriant mat of black hair off her legs. The ancient sleeveless blouse had given way to a soft wool sweater. She'd even had a permanent. Dodie was a girl transformed, and you could see by her face that she knew it. I have no idea if she saved for those new clothes, if they were given to her for Christmas by her parents, or if she went through a hell of begging that finally bore dividends. It doesn't matter, because mere clothes changed nothing. The teasing that day was worse than ever. Her peers had no intention of letting her out of the box they'd put her in. She was punished for even trying to break free. I had several classes with her and was able to observe Dodie's ruination at first hand. I saw her smile fade, saw the light in her eyes first dim and then go out. By the end of the day, she was the girl she'd been before Christmas vacation, a dough-faced and freckle-cheeked wraith, scurrying through the halls with her eyes down and her books clasped to her chest. She wore the new skirt and sweater the next day, and the next, and the next. When the school year ended, she was still wearing them, although by then the weather was much too hot for wool, and there were always beads of sweat at her temples and on her upper lip. The home permanent wasn't repeated, and the new clothes took on a matted, dispirited look. But the teasing had dropped back to its pre-Christmas levels, and the taunting stopped entirely. Someone made a break for the fence and had to be knocked down, that was all. Once the escape was foiled and the entire company of prisoners was once more accounted for, life could go back to normal. Both Sandra and Dodie were dead by the time I started writing Carrie. Sandra moved out of the trailer in Durham, out from beneath the agonal gaze of the dying savior, and into an apartment in Lisbon Falls. She must have worked somewhere close by, probably in one of the mills or shoe factories. She was epileptic and died during a seizure. She lived alone, so there was no one to help her when she went down with her head bent the wrong way. Dodie married a TV weatherman who gained something of a reputation in New England for his drawling down east delivery. Following the birth of a child, I think it was their second, Dodie went into the cellar and put a .22 bullet in her abdomen. It was a lucky shot, or unlucky, depending on your point of view, I guess, hitting the portal vein and killing her. In town, they said it was postpartum depression. How sad. Myself, I suspected high school hangover might have had something to do with it. I never liked Carrie, that female version of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, but through Sandra and Dodie, I came at last to understand her a little. I pitied her, and I pitied her classmates as well, because I had been one of them once upon a time. The manuscript of Carrie went off to Doubleday, where I had made a friend named William Thompson. I pretty much forgot about it and moved on with my life, which at that time consisted of teaching school, raising kids, loving my wife, getting drunk on Friday afternoons, and writing stories. My free period that semester was 5, right after lunch. I usually spent it in the teacher's room, grading papers and wishing I could stretch out on the couch and take a nap. In the early afternoon, I have all the energy of a boa constrictor that's just swallowed a goat. The intercom came on, and Colleen Seitz in the office asked if I was there. I said I was, and she asked me to come up to the office. I had a phone call. My wife. The walk from the teacher's room in the lower wing to the main office seemed long, even with classes in session and the halls mostly empty. I hurried, not quite running, my heart beating hard. Tabby would have had to dress the kids in their boots and jackets to use the neighbor's phone, and I could think of only two reasons she might have done so. Either Joe or Naomi had fallen off the stoop and broken a leg, or I had sold Carrie. My wife, sounding out of breath but deliriously happy, read me a telegram. Bill Thompson, who would later go on to discover a Mississippi scribbler named John Grisham, had sent it after trying to call and discovering the Kings no longer had a phone. "Congratulations," it read. "Carrie officially a Doubleday book. Is $2,500 advance okay? The future lies ahead. Love, Bill." $2,500 was a very small advance, even for the early 70s, but I didn't know that and had no literary agent to know it for me. Before it occurred to me that I might actually need an agent, I had generated well over $3 million worth of income, a good deal of it for the publisher. The standard Doubleday contract in those days was better than indentured servitude, but not much. And my little high school horror novel marched toward publication with excruciating slowness. Although it was accepted in late March or early April of 1973, publication wasn't slated until the spring of 1974. This wasn't unusual. In those days, Doubleday was an enormous fiction mill churning out mysteries, romances, science fiction yarns, and double D westerns at a rate of 50 or more a month. All of this in addition to a robust front list, including books by heavy hitters like Leon Uris and Alan Drury. I was only one small fish in a very busy river. Tabby asked if I could quit teaching. I told her no, not based on a $2,500 advance and only nebulous possibilities beyond that. If I'd been on my own, maybe, hell, probably, but with a wife and two kids, not happening. I remember the two of us lying in bed that night, eating toast and talking until the small hours of the morning. Tabby asked me how much we'd make if Doubleday was able to sell the paperback reprint rights to Carrie, and I said I didn't know. I'd read that Mario Puzo had just scored a huge advance for paperback rights to The Godfather, $400,000, according to the newspaper, but I didn't believe Carrie would fetch anything near that, assuming it sold to paperback at all. Tabby asked, rather timidly for my normally outspoken wife, if I thought the book would find a paperback publisher. I told her I thought the chances were pretty good, maybe 7 or 8 in 10. She asked how much it might bring. I said my best guess would be somewhere between $10,000 and $60,000. $60,000? She sounded almost shocked. Is that much even possible? I said it was. Not likely, perhaps, but possible. I also reminded her that my contract specified a 50-50 paperback split, which meant that if Ballantyne or Dell did pay $60,000, we'd only get 30. Tabby didn't dignify this with a reply. She didn't have to. $30,000 was what I could expect to make in 4 years of teaching, even with annual salary increases thrown in. It was a lot of money, probably just pie in the sky, but it was a night for dreaming. Carrie inched along toward publication. We spent the advance on a new car, a standard shift that Tabby hated and reviled in her most colorful mill worker's language, and I signed a teaching contract for the 1973-1974 academic year. I was writing a new novel, a peculiar combination of Peyton Place and Dracula, which I called Second Coming. We had moved to a ground-floor apartment back in Bangor, a real pit, but we were in town again. We had a car covered by an actual warranty, and we had a telephone. To tell you the truth, Carrie had fallen off my radar screen almost completely. The kids were a handful, both the ones at school and the ones at home, and I had begun to worry about my mother. She was 61, still working at Pineland Training Center, and as funny as ever, but Dave said she didn't feel very well a lot of the time. Her bedside table was covered with prescription painkillers, and he was afraid there might be something seriously wrong with her. "She's always smoked like a chimney, you know," Dave said. He was a great one to talk, since he smoked like a chimney himself. So did I, and how my wife hated the expense and constant ashy dirt of it. But I knew what he meant, and although I didn't live as close to her as Dave and didn't see her as often, the last time I had seen her, I could tell she had lost weight. "What can we do?" I asked. Behind the question was all we knew of our mother, who kept herself to herself, as she liked to say. The result of that philosophy was a vast gray space where other families have histories. Dave and I knew almost nothing about our father or his family, and little enough about our own mother's past, which included an incredible, to me at least, 8 dead brothers and sisters, and her own failed ambition to become a concert pianist. She did play the organ on some of the NBC radio soaps and Sunday church shows during the war, she claimed. "We can't do anything," Dave replied, "until she asks." One Sunday, not long after that call, I got another one from Bill Thompson at Doubleday. I was alone in the apartment. Tabby had packed the kids off to her mother's for a visit, and I was working on the new book, which I thought of as Vampires in Our Town. "Are you sitting down?" Bill asked. "No," I said. Our phone hung on the kitchen wall, and I was standing in the doorway between the kitchen and the living room. "Do I need to?" "You might," he said. "The paperback rights to Carrie went to Signet Books for $400,000. When I was a little kid, Daddy Guy had once said to my mother, "Why don't you shut that kid up, Ruth? When Stephen opens his mouth, all his guts fall out." It was true then, has been true all my life. But on that Mother's Day in May of 1973, I was completely speechless. I stood there in the doorway, casting the same shadow as always, but I couldn't talk. Bill asked if I was still there, kind of laughing as he said it. He knew I was. I hadn't heard him right. Couldn't have. The idea allowed me to find my voice again, at least. "Did you say it went for $40,000? $400,000, he said. "Under the rules of the road," meaning the contract I'd signed, $200K of it's yours. Congratulations, Steve." I was still standing in the doorway, looking across the living room toward our bedroom and the crib where Joe slept. Our place on Sanford Street rented for $90 a month, and this man I'd only met once face to face was telling me I'd just won the lottery. The strength ran out of my legs. I didn't fall exactly, but I kind of whooshed down to a sitting position there in the doorway. "Are you sure?" I asked Bill. He said he was. I asked him to say the number again, very slowly and very clearly, so I could be sure I hadn't misunderstood. He said the number was a 4, followed by 5 zeros. After that, a decimal point and 2 more zeros, he added. We talked for another half an hour, but I don't remember a single word of what we said. When the conversation was over, I tried to call Tabby at her mother's. Her youngest sister, Marcella, said Tab had already left. I walked back and forth through the apartment in my stocking feet, exploding with good news and without an ear to hear it. I was shaking all over. At last, I pulled on my shoes and walked downtown. The only store that was open on Bangor's Main Street was the Laverdier Drug. I suddenly felt that I had to buy Tabby a Mother's Day present, something wild and extravagant. I tried, but here's one of life's true facts. There's nothing really wild or extravagant for sale at Laverdier's. I did the best I could. I got her a hairdryer. When I got back home, she was in the kitchen, unpacking the baby bags and singing along with the radio. I gave her the hairdryer. She looked at it as if she'd never seen one before. "What's this for?" she asked. I took her by the shoulders. I told her about the paperback sale. She didn't appear to understand. I told her again. Tabby looked over my shoulder at our shitty little four-room apartment, just as I had, and began to cry. I got drunk for the first time in 1966. This was on the senior class trip to Washington. We went on a bus, about 40 kids and three chaperones. One of them was old Q-Ball, as a matter of fact, and spent the first night in New York, where the drinking age was then 18. Thanks to my bad ears and shitty tonsils, I was almost 19, room to spare. A bunch of us more adventurous boys found a package store around the corner from the hotel. I cast an eye over the shelves, aware that my spending money was far from a fortune. There was too much, too many bottles, too many brands, too many prices over $10. Finally, I gave up and asked the guy behind the counter, the same bald, bored-looking, gray-coated guy who has, I'm convinced, sold alcohol virgins their first bottle since the dawn of commerce, what was cheap. Without a word, he put a pint of old log cabin whiskey down on the Winston mat beside the cash register. The sticker on the label said $1.95. The price was right. I have a memory of being led onto the elevator later that night, or maybe it was early the next morning, by Peter Higgins, old Q-Ball's son, Butch Michaud, Lenny Partridge, and John Chismar. This memory is more like a scene from a TV show than a real memory. I seem to be outside of myself, watching the whole thing. There's just enough of me left inside to know that I am globally, perhaps even galactically, fucked up. The camera watches as we go up to the girls' floor. The camera watches as I am propelled up and down the hall, a kind of rolling exhibit. An amusing one, it seems. The girls are in nighties, robes, curlers, cold cream. They are all laughing at me, but their laughter seems good-natured enough. The sound is muted, as if I am hearing them through cotton. I am trying to tell Carol Lemke that I love the way she wears her hair, and that she has the most beautiful blue eyes in the world. What comes out is something like, "Aga wuggin blue eyes, wuggin ruggin whole world." Carol laughs and nods as if she understands completely. I am very happy. The world is seeing an asshole, no doubt, but he is a happy asshole, and everyone loves him. I spend several minutes trying to tell Gloria Moore that I've discovered the secret life of Dean Martin. At some point after that, I am in my bed. The bed holds still, but the room starts to spin around it faster and faster. It occurs to me that it's spinning like the turntable of my Webcore phonograph, on which I used to play Fats Domino and now play Dylan in the Dave Clark Five. The room is the turntable. I am the spindle, and pretty soon the spindle is going to start tossing its platters. I go away for a little bit. When I wake up, I'm on my knees in the bathroom of the double room I'm sharing with my friend, Louis Purington. I have no idea how I got in there, but it's good that I did, because the toilet is full of bright yellow puke. Looks like niblets, I think, and that's all it takes to get me going again. Nothing comes up but whiskey-flavored strings of spit, but my head feels like it's going to explode. I can't walk. I crawl back to bed with my sweaty hair hanging in my eyes. I'll feel better tomorrow, I think, and then I go away again. In the morning, my stomach is settled a little, but my diaphragm is sore from vomiting, and my head is throbbing like a mouthful of infected teeth. My eyes have turned into magnifying glasses. The hideously bright morning light coming in through the hotel windows is being concentrated by them and will soon set my brains on fire. Participating in that day's scheduled activities, a walk to Times Square, a boat ride to the Statue of Liberty, a climb to the top of the Empire State Building, is out of the question. Walking? Irk. Boats? Double irk. Elevators? Irk to the fourth power. Christ, I can hardly move. I make some sort of feeble excuse and spend most of the day in bed. By late afternoon, I'm feeling a little better. I dress, creep down the hall to the elevator, and descend to the first floor. Eating is still impossible, but I believe I'm ready for a ginger ale, a cigarette, and a magazine. And who should I see in the lobby, sitting in a chair and reading a newspaper, but Mr. Earl Higgins, alias Old Cue Ball? I pass him as silently as I can, but it's no good. When I come back from the gift shop, he's sitting with his newspaper in his lap, looking at me. I feel my stomach drop. Here is more trouble with the principal, probably even worse than the trouble I got into over the village vomit. He calls me over, and I discover something interesting. Mr. Higgins is actually an okay guy. He bounced me pretty hard over my joke newspaper, but perhaps Miss Margotin had insisted on that. And I'd just been 16, after all. On the day of my first hangover, I'm going on 19. I've been accepted at the state university, and I have a mill job waiting for me when the class trip is over. I understand you were too sick to tour New York with the rest of the boys and girls, old Cue Ball says. He eyes me up and down. I say, that's right, I'd been sick. A shame for you to miss the fun, old Cue Ball says. Feeling better now? Yes, I was feeling better. Probably stomach flu, one of those 24-hour bugs. I hope you won't get that bug again, he says. At least, not on this trip. He looks at me for a moment longer, his eyes asking if we understand each other. I'm sure I won't, I say, meaning it. I know what drunk is like now, a vague sense of roaring goodwill, a clearer sense that most of your consciousness is out of your body, hovering like a camera in a science fiction movie and filming everything. And then the sickness, the puking, the aching head. No, I won't get that bug again, I tell myself. Not on this trip, not ever. Once is enough, just to find out what it's like. Only an idiot would make a second experiment, and only a lunatic, a masochistic lunatic, would make booze a regular part of his life. The next day we go on to Washington, making one stop in Amish country on the way. There's a liquor store near where the bus parks. I go in and look around. Although the drinking age in Pennsylvania is 21, I must look easily that in my one good suit and Faza's old black overcoat. In fact, I probably look like a freshly released young convict, tall and hungry and very likely not bolted together right. The clerk sells me a fifth of four roses without asking to see any ID, and by the time we stop for the night, I'm drunk again. 10 years or so later, I'm in an Irish saloon with Bill Thompson. We have lots to celebrate, not the least of which is the completion of my third book, The Shining. That's the one which just happens to be about an alcoholic writer and ex-school teacher. It's July, the night of the All-Star baseball game. Our plan is to eat a good old-fashioned meal from the dishes set out on the steam table, then get shit-faced. We begin with a couple at the bar, and I start reading all the signs. Have a Manhattan in Manhattan, says one. Tuesdays are twofers, says another. Work is the curse of the drinking class, says a third. And there, right in front of me, is one which reads, Early Bird Special, Screwdrivers a Buck, Monday to Friday, 8 to 10 a.m. I motion to the bartender. He comes over. He's bald. He's wearing a gray jacket. He could be the guy who sold me my first pint back in 1966. Probably he is. I point to the sign and ask, who comes in at 8:15 in the morning and orders a screwdriver? I'm smiling, but he doesn't smile back. College boys, he replies. Just like you. In 1971 or 72, Mom's sister, Carolyn Weimer, died of breast cancer. My mother and my Aunt Ethlyn, Carolyn's twin, flew out to Aunt Cal's funeral in Minnesota. It was the first time my mother had flown in 20 years. On the plane trip back, she began to bleed profusely from what she would have called her privates. Although long past her change of life by that point, she told herself it was simply one final menstrual period. Locked in the tiny bathroom of a bouncing TWA jet, she stanched the bleeding with tampons. Plug it up, plug it up, as Sue Snell and her friends might have cried. Then returned to her seat. She said nothing to Ethlyn and nothing to David and me. She didn't go to see Joe Mendes in Lisbon Falls, her physician since time out of mind. Instead of any of those things, she did what she always did in times of trouble, kept herself to herself. For a while, things seemed to be all right. She enjoyed her job. She enjoyed her friends. She enjoyed her four grandchildren, two from Dave's family and two from mine. Then things stopped being all right. In August of 1973, during a checkup following an operation to strip some of her outrageously varicose veins, my mother was diagnosed with uterine cancer. I think Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King, who once dumped a bowl of Jell-O on the floor and then danced in it while her two boys lay collapsed in the corner, screaming with laughter, actually died of embarrassment. The end came in February of 1974. By then, a little of the money from Carrie had begun to flow, and I was able to help with some of the medical expenses. There was that much to be glad about. And I was there for the last of it, staying in the back bedroom of Dave and Linda's place. I'd been drunk the night before, but was only moderately hungover, which was good. One wouldn't want to be too hungover at the deathbed of one's mother. Dave woke me up at 6:15 in the morning, calling softly through the door that he thought she was going. When I got into the master bedroom, he was sitting beside her on the bed and holding a cool for her to smoke. This she did between harsh gasps for breath. She was only semi-conscious, her eyes going from Dave to me and then back to Dave again. I sat next to Dave, took the cigarette, and held it to her mouth. Her lips stretched out to clamp on the filter. Beside her bed, reflected over and over again in a cluster of glasses, was an early-bound galley of Carrie. Aunt Ethlyn had read it to her aloud a month or so before she died. Mom's eyes went from Dave to me, Dave to me, Dave to me. She had gone from 160 pounds to about 90. Her skin was yellow and so tightly stretched that she looked like one of those mummies they parade through the streets of Mexico on the Day of the Dead. We took turns holding the cigarette for her, and when it was down to the filter, I put it out. "My boys," she said, then lapsed into what might have been sleep or unconsciousness. My head ached. I took a couple of aspirin from one of the many bottles of medicine on her table. Dave held one of her hands, and I held the other. Under the sheet was not the body of our mother, but that of a starved and deformed child. Dave and I smoked and talked a little. I don't remember what we said. It had rained the night before, then the temperature had dropped, and the morning streets were filled with ice. We could hear the pause after each rasping breath she drew, growing longer and longer. Finally, there were no more breaths, and it was all pause. My mother was buried out of the Congregational Church at Southwest Bend. The church she'd attended in Methodist Corners, where my brother and I grew up, was closed because of the cold. I gave the eulogy. I think I did a pretty good job considering how drunk I was. 35. Alcoholics build defenses like the Dutch build dikes. I spent the first 12 years or so of my married life assuring myself that I just liked to drink. I also employed the world-famous Hemingway defense. Although never clearly articulated, it would not be manly to do so. The Hemingway defense goes something like this. As a writer, I am a very sensitive fellow, but I am also a man, and real men don't give in to their sensitivities. Only sissy men do that. Therefore, I drink. How else can I face the existential horror of it all and continue to work? Besides, come on, I can handle it. A real man always can. Then, in the early 80s, Maine's legislature enacted a returnable bottle and can law. Instead of going into the trash, my 16-ounce cans of Miller Lite started going into a plastic container in the garage. One Thursday night, I went out there to toss in a few dead soldiers and saw that this container, which had been empty on Monday night, was now almost full. And since I was the only one in the house who drank Miller Lite, holy shit, I'm an alcoholic, I thought. And there was no dissenting opinion from inside my head. I was, after all, the guy who had written The Shining without even realizing, at least until that night, that I was writing about myself. My reaction to this idea wasn't denial or disagreement. It was what I'd call frightened determination. You have to be careful then, I clearly remember thinking. Because if you fuck up, if I fucked up, rolled my car over on a back road some night, or blew an interview on live TV, someone would tell me I ought to get control of my drinking, and telling an alcoholic to control his drinking is like telling a guy suffering the world's most cataclysmic case of diarrhea to control his shitting. A friend of mine who's been through this tells an amusing story about his first tentative effort to get a grip on his increasingly slippery life. He went to a counselor and said his wife was worried that he was drinking too much. "How much do you drink?" the counselor asked. My friend looked at the counselor with disbelief. "All of it," he said, as if that should have been self-evident. I know how he felt. It's been almost 12 years since I took a drink, and I'm still struck by disbelief when I see someone in a restaurant with a half-finished glass of wine near at hand. I want to get up, go over, and yell, "Finish that! Why don't you finish that?" into his or her face. I found the idea of social drinking ludicrous. If you didn't want to get drunk, why not just have a Coke? My nights during the last 5 years of my drinking always ended with the same ritual. I'd pour any beers left in the refrigerator down the sink. If I didn't, they'd talk to me as I lay in bed until I got up and had another. And another. And one more.